Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
A shocking ad campaign sweeps the streets of Lebanon. Is it stoking sectarian strife or taming the flame? Another Iraqi priest is abducted in Baghdad, and Father Tom Williams with tips on practicing the Christian call to interfaith dialogue. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
For whites only, no Negroes allowed. It wasn't so long ago that those kinds of signs could be found on buses and bathrooms across the United States. But for the generations born after the Civil Rights Movement and the 1960s, labeling anyone based on their color, race, or creed seems like ancient history. That's why a new ad campaign sweeping Lebanon is so shocking. One billboard proclaims, "Parking reserved for Maronite Christians only." A real estate ad is for prospective Sunni Muslim buyers only, who wish to live in an all-Sunni neighborhood. An employment listing, only Druze need apply. A modeling agency is looking for a Shiite face. Another outrageous ad is posted by a Maronite Christian selling a car, owned and maintained by a Maronite, and get this, never driven by non-Maronites. Well, in a country made up of 17 different religious confessions, Christian, Muslim, and Druze, the ad campaign is at first deeply disturbing, especially in a moment where political rivalry between pro-Syrian and anti-Syrian blocs threatens to turn into civil war. But the message is in the fine print, so to speak. Stop sectarianism before it stops us. The campaign is the brainchild of AMAM, Arabic for Forward. It's a non-governmental organization made up of Christian, Sunni, Shiite, and Druze volunteers, concerned that inflamed sectarian tensions could turn ugly in Lebanon, which is still trying to rebuild after the civil war ended in 1990. They masterminded the ad campaign to shock the Lebanese into thinking about what kind of country do they want to live in after all.
A shocking wake-up call was needed.
Asma Andraus, a Greek Orthodox, is president of AMAM. She told me Lebanon needs to confront its past in order to face the future.
We have already faced the problem of confessionalism at its most violent during the civil war Lebanon went through in the 70s and the 80s and all the way down to the end of the 80s. And since then, of course, we've gone into some kind of amnesia and we sort of never really talk about what happened or why it happened or how to make sure it doesn't happen again. And we find ourselves again today in a very polarized state of mind with a country that is very much split. And I know a lot of people are saying it's split along political lines, but it's also split along sectarian lines. And whether we like it or not, we are part of a region which is undergoing sectarian violence, be it in Iraq. So this is why we thought it was urgent to do something. We chose it to be shocking, but at the same time funny, in the sense of ridicule. I mean, funny in the sense of, you know, the pictures that are depicted in these visuals are all absurd pictures. I mean, there is no such thing as a parking lot that is dedicated to Maronites only, or a building that is sold to Druze only, etc., etc., or a doctor that only has Sunni patients, or, you know, and we don't yet have our confessions on our car plates. What we're saying, really, what we're trying to say is be careful. If we're not careful about this, we might well end up becoming that.
Have you talked to people for their reactions to these ads,
well,
to these billboards?
We've received hundreds of emails and hundreds of phone calls. So people spontaneously reacted, and reactions are very diverse. You have a lot of people who loved it, who said, you know, it's such a responsible campaign and it's such a good timing for it, and thank God for people like you around. And so, okay, obviously these are the ones that maybe are the least confessional of us all, or maybe not. But anyway, they were happily surprised. This campaign was put up on billboards on the roads. It appeared in the media in most of the daily newspapers in Lebanon for a 2-week period, and it also traveled on internet extensively. And some of the diaspora, I imagine that those Lebanese people that haven't been back to Lebanon in a while, that were touched by the campaign because it touches obviously on topics that are dear to them, that thought that this was real. So they were really panicked. They sent us back emails saying, really? Is this how bad it's become? And where are these parking lots? And where are these buildings? So we actually got back to them and saying, you know, this was not a real case scenario. This was something that we had simulated, but that we hoped that we would never really get there. And there are those who said, what's your alternative? And so we, of course, always say we have no alternative. We're not pretending to be experts or specialists. We're not politicians. We have not gone into the depths of the matter or of the problem. What we're saying is that the excess of confessionalism and sectarianism can be dangerous, and that we may be reaching those levels of danger. So this is really, we've had three kinds of reactions. People who were very supportive, people who were scared that this was for real, people who thought, you know, that, you know, it's all very nice pointing it out, but what is your alternative? And we had obviously very few, but we did have them, a couple of people who said, you know, sectarianism is good and it's a way to protect minorities and you should not attack the system and, you know.
I noticed that many of your ads are in English, so you are trying to send a message outside of Lebanon to the diaspora.
No, our ads have all been up in three languages. They've been in Arabic, they've been in English, and they've been up in French. The reason for that is that, as some of you may know, the Lebanese people do speak three languages. Some speak French, some speak Arabic, some speak English. We also did want to reach our diaspora overseas, who maybe hasn't, you know, has lost the Arabic or is not as comfortable with the Arabic anymore. And so we in the English daily newspaper, they were in English. In the French daily newspaper, they were in French. And in all the Arabic daily newspapers, they were in Arabic. So we did not particularly favor one language over the other. Now, of course, we did want it to be in more than just Arabic for that diaspora, because it's important that they are also part of it.
Now, I know there was a particular moment when you decided to form AMAM. It was back in 2005. Could you explain to our listeners what exactly prompted you to think that an organization like this had to be formed?
Well, the organization came together quite spontaneously following the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri in February 2005. Some of us did not know each other. We met on the streets during protests because at the time, I mean, as most people recall, there was a whole wave of protests that eventually drove Syrian occupation out of Lebanon and that secured an international tribunal for to try the assassination. So we came together spontaneously at the time. We started a street petition. We got very much involved in the events that followed leading up to March 14th, where about 1 million people hit the streets. And then when that was over, of course, some of us just said, you know, that's it. We've done what we want to do and we don't want to do anymore. And others said, you know, we can maybe make a difference, although we're a small group and although we're not pretending to be neither a political party nor a big formation. But maybe we can try and do something. Maybe we can try and do something to get to that Lebanon we dream of, which is a secular, modern, non-feudal state where rule of law prevails. We are aware that this takes a long time, of course, in a system like ours. We're aware that it requires a lot of awareness, a lot of education. And so this is how it started, really. It started spontaneously. We got a bit more, you know, we got better organized as time went on. We became more official. We registered with the Ministry of Interior. And since then, we've undergone a few projects. Some in far out remote regions working with youth, and some like this campaign on just awareness building on topics that are particular to our society.
You talked about your dreams there for a future ideal Lebanon. What is your worst nightmare scenario?
Another war. That is my worst nightmare scenario. Another civil war.
You mentioned earlier that the street protests, the demonstrations we've been seeing, are not strictly political. You do say that they are sectarian in nature. Could you try to explain it to people who are not in Lebanon and they don't understand exactly how one distinguishes one from the other in Lebanon?
Well, there are two ways to look at the protests that are taking place right now. There are on the one hand, it's what is called the opposition, which is mainly pro-Syrian, which is rallying against the actual government, which is the government that was elected following Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon. So that's one way of looking at it. So in that, to that extent, it's purely political. You know, you have Christians on both sides, you have Druze on both sides, you have Sunnis on both sides, and you have a majority of Shia, which are with the pro-Syrian camp, if I have to simplify, because obviously this is all very simplified. Now, on the other hand, we again live in a region where Sunni and Shia sectarianism is becoming a danger because of the Iraqi situation. And it happens that the two major camps of Sunnis and Shias in Lebanon today are not in the same political camp. So the protesters today are mainly Shia, and the Sunnis mainly support the existing government, which the protesters are trying to topple down. So we are worried and we are concerned that what has started as a pure political movement will turn into a Sunni-Shia sectarian divide. And as you all know, it is very easy to start with a few isolated incidents and grow into something more systematic. And then, you know, then it becomes very difficult to stop anything. Then violence takes over reason, and then we know what happens because we've been through all this before.
But also, let me just point out that the Christians, there are so many different Christian communities there as well in Lebanon. They also are divided
on
political lines.
They are also divided, of course. Well, again, you have Christians in each one of the two camps, and we have gone back to another divide, which again in 89 and 90 also took us into a war, which is a part of the Christians led by Samir Jaja, who is a Lebanese forces leader, who support the government, and other Christians led by General Michel Aoun, who support the opposition. And these two have already been in a war, one against the other, in the late 80s, and they drove the country to the very edge, and they divided the Christians tremendously then. And this is another fear, that this is going to be happening again, and that we see history repeating itself, which is something that obviously my generation of people really does not want to see happen, because we've given it 15 years. It's taken us another 15 to get out of, and this the mere thought of us having to go back into all of that is so frightening, I'd rather imagine it was impossible.
You just brought up a very interesting point. Many of the people we've been seeing participating in the demonstrations in downtown Beirut, for example, are young Lebanese, it seems, from the post-war generation. Are you concerned that they have not really learned the lessons that their parents and their grandparents have learned from the Civil War?
I'm concerned that they have no idea what war is like, because, of course, they were born after the war. And I'm amazed that their parents haven't taught them anything about the uselessness of the war. I was old enough during the war. I'm 35 now, so when the war started I was 4. So I was a teenager during the war. And I really, really wish that the parents of all these kids, whatever camp they come from and whatever side of the spectrum they come from, just tell their children what it was like during the war, because we really don't want to go back there.
Lebanon never really had a process like, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in post-apartheid South Africa. Did the Lebanese really, it sounds like they swept the divisions from the Civil War under the carpet without fully addressing them. Did they ever come to fully reconcile after that Civil War?
You're quite right, Friede. There was never an in-depth work to do that. We went into some kind of reconstruction frenzy, and therefore we went into an amnesia about what happened during the war. And what you see today is warlords that then spent 15 years ripping each other's throats open, now reconciled and, you know, all friendly and politically allied. So Lebanon is a strange country in that sense. The foes of the past become friends of today, and God knows what happens tomorrow. So maybe this is something, and I know there are, AMAM as an NGO has not been particularly active on that front, but I know other associations have. Really what is needed is work on memory. It's possibly, you know, a moment where everyone sits together and say, hey, we did actually kill each other up. And maybe we can talk about it. Obviously today is not the right time to do it, because we're on the verge of doing it again if we're not very, very careful. But really I think this is work that needs to be done. It needs to be done so that generations who didn't go through the war know about it. And it needs to be done so that generations who did go through the war, and even those who actually took part in it, whatever side they were standing on at the time, realize the absurdity and the extent of the damage. But, you know, it's quite clear today. I mean, who won? Who won anything from this war? No one. Everyone loses in a war.
That's something that Pope John Paul II used to always say. War is always a defeat for humanity. There are so many issues that just seem to remain open wounds there in Lebanon that were never really addressed. I'm thinking also of the so many people who disappeared during the Civil War. So has ever there been a process to find out where these people ended up and to give some sort of comfort and solace to the families?
There has to a large extent. Obviously, there remain, I imagine, cases where things would never be known. You know, a civil war is something very ugly. A civil war is not about an aggressor coming in and bombing you and then leaving like the one we had this summer. A civil war is very different. A civil war is dirty, it's low, it's one of the ugliest things that humanity can know. It's not... Obviously, all wars are disgusting, but a civil war is sick. It is Lebanese people killing other Lebanese people on the basis of, confession or faith or religion or whatever. And in these cases, the ugliest things happen, and people, bury people really deep, or they burn people, or things happen so that you can try and remove the trace from history. Now, of course, with time, things come up to the surface, as was found out last summer and the summer before. You know, they found mass graves, and they found places where they found human bones and human skeletons, and then they retraced it back to the late 80s. I'm not sure that opening up all the wounds is the best thing one can do, but I do think that we need to sit and talk about what happened, why it happened, and why we should not allow it ever to happen again. Now, whether we need to go into the very details of it, how they went about it, what they did with the people's corpses, I don't know, how healthy that is. It's only going to revive wounds. It's only going to open up anger again. Now, of course, I understand that some families are very distressed and have never really, known anything but what happened to the people, their beloved ones, that just were kidnapped or disappeared overnight or... I understand this is very difficult, and I thank the Lord that I did not have to go through this myself. But there are things I guess we will never find out.
So what do you think it'll take to get the Lebanese to sit down and talk about these issues and try to reconcile their differences?
I just hope that all the politicians, because we remain in Lebanon, unfortunately, people are still very much followers of what this or that leader has to say. I just really hope, and I, if any of them are listening to this by chance, I really hope they hear me. It is essential today that any and all politicians act very responsibly, really. I mean, just take everyone off the streets. Everyone go back home. Let's sit on a table. Let's talk about this. We can talk about this. Street protests are not going to resolve anything. They're not going to allow any possibility of people actually listening and understanding one another. The only way to do that, and the only way to avoid violence, and the only way to avoid incidents, and the only way to avoid antagonism and polarization and extremism is to actually prone dialogue, more dialogue, more dialogue, and more dialogue. There is no reason why, if we sit together, we cannot actually hear and understand one another. It just takes very responsible politicians. But the times are times of crisis, and it is required of each and every one of them to be the most responsible he or she has ever been in their lives.
Asma Andraus is president of AMAM, a non-governmental organization in Beirut aiming to stop sectarianism before it stops the Lebanese. And to get a look at some of the ads out on the streets in Lebanon, you can log on AMAM's website. Their address is www.05amam, that's AMAM.org. Turning elsewhere in the Middle East, to Iraq, where wanton violence continues to claim innocent lives. The Chaldean Patriarchate authorities late Monday announced that another Chaldean priest was abducted in Baghdad. Father Sami al-Rais was taken by unknown men just a few meters from his home near the Church of St. George in the Iraqi capital. Father Sami is rector and professor at the major seminary of the Chaldean Patriarchate, which was due to restart lessons after security pressures closed it down. The few seminarians there say the closure is now indefinite without their rector. Father Sammy's abduction comes a week after another Chaldean priest, Father Douglas Yusuf Albazi, from St. Elias Parish in Baghdad, was released after 9 days in captivity. Lydia O'Kane spoke about the kidnappings with Daniel Hoffman, president of Middle East Concern, a human rights organization focusing on the plight of Christians in the region.
Of course, it's not only Christians who are kidnapped. Quite a number of people are kidnapped in Iraq these days. There are different reasons. Some of them have a predominantly criminal element. It's for money. And also Christians are abducted for these reasons because they are perceived to be wealthier. And also they are usually not part of larger tribes that can give them protection. There is also, in some kidnappings, there is a religious element where Christians are perceived by some Islamic groups not to be protected by Islam, and therefore they can be kidnapped. Sometimes also they're kidnapped in reaction to certain events, like the speech of the Pope last September or the Danish cartoons earlier this year. So there are different reasons why they can be kidnapped.
The Christian community would be relatively small in Iraq, so is it the security situation getting increasingly harsher for Christians living in the country, do you think?
Yes, very much so. The security situation in general has been deteriorating considerably the last few years, especially since the beginning of this year. But also the situation for Christians has become much more precarious. You mentioned earlier this is the second kidnapping since last week, but I think it's the sixth since September of this year. So there is quite an increase in attacks. And it's not just kidnappings. There are also an increase of threats against Christians in a number of the bigger cities. They have received notices that they have to financially support the Islamic groups or face attacks against their persons or buildings. So there is an increase of pressure on Christian girls to wear the veil and otherwise dress according to Islamic dress code. So yes, there has been a significant increase in the security situation of Christians in Iraq.
I mean, the last Chaldean priest, he was 9 days in captivity and he was just released. So are they looking for ransoms? Is that the idea? Because this priest was released, and I know others may not have been that fortunate, but is there a general pattern to this?
It's difficult to know. Of course, the people involved don't admit whether or not ransom has been paid. But yeah, earlier, I think in September, October, there were two priests who were kidnapped, and they were also released. And then last month, there was a Syrian Orthodox priest in Mosul, where the family managed to get together some ransom money, but the abductors broke off all contact and he was found killed the next day. And just a few days ago, there was a Presbyterian church leader also in Mosul was kidnapped and ransom negotiations were still ongoing. Suddenly contact was broken off by the abductors and he was found killed just a few days ago. So it's not completely clear why sometimes they are released. Sometimes even in the middle of negotiations, they are killed.
So what can be done, or what is being done, do you think, to improve the security situation for the minority of Christians? Do you know of any measures that are being put in place to stop this from happening?
Well, a lot of the Christians in Iraq themselves are fleeing to safer places. You have hundreds of thousands of them who've fled the country altogether, usually either to Jordan or to Syria. And you have even more Christians who have fled to the north, where there are areas which are predominantly Christian, which are in the Kurdish-controlled, which are more quiet and safer in general. And you have larger numbers of Christians who went there for safety. Otherwise, I'm not aware of specific activities, either by the church or by the government, to protect the Christians in general.
Your organization, what involvement do you necessarily have with all this?
With the abductions, the only involvement we have is to raise awareness and to raise prayer for people who abducted in Christian circles worldwide.
Daniel Hoffman, president of Middle East Concern, speaking there with Lydia O'Kane. How can we put our faith into practice in our everyday lives, especially at a time when many see religion as a cause of conflict rather than a cause for peace? Father Tom Williams, Rector of Theology at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, sat down with me for some insight on interfaith dialogue, not between religious leaders, but beginning with the common Christian.
I think that this is ever more important. We live in such a pluralistic world, a pluralistic society now, that we are continually coming in contact with people of other faiths. And we have two options. We can either close ourselves into a sort of ghetto, a self-imposed ghetto, or we can open ourselves up to learn from them, to share with them our own faith, and to really make that coming into contact something fruitful for both of us.
Okay, but how do I do that? I'm Sue Smith, and I'm living in Oklahoma City, and I've got, you know, my own problems, my own issues every day. Why should it be important to me?
Well, because, Sue Smith, you probably have friends who are of different faiths. You run into people all the time. It's important in the first place for you to know about them, what they believe, why they believe what they believe. It helps even your friendships grow. It helps your understanding of them grow. And also, you're called as a Christian to witness to your own faith. And part of being in society is going beyond your own problems, which are very real, to also share your faith with other people, to know it in the first place and be willing to express it and talk about it with other people as well.
So, how should we Christians react when we're faced with terrible human tragedies caused by someone from another faith? Tragedies like 9/11 or other acts of terrorism?
Well, there's all sorts of historical animosity built up between people of different countries and people of different religions. And we as Christians firmly believe, it's part of a central part of our faith, that we're called to forgive and overcome those differences. In the first place, because a country or a religion was not itself responsible for those wrongs that we're looking at. It was, as you said, a group of individuals. And even as regard to that group of individuals, when they do wrong, we're called to forgive, as difficult as it is. But especially as regards the broader group, we have to be able to distinguish between those who actually perpetrated the crime and then an entire religion, entire faith tradition, or an entire culture. And I think there we need a lot of open-mindedness and also a big Christian heart. That's what we're called to be able to forgive, to be able to overlook that, and also to really, again, want to enter into a more fruitful dialogue with these different cultures.
Okay, cuts both ways, though, too, doesn't it? I should get people from other faiths to understand me and my religion and who I am as a person.
Well, I think that it's essential to Christianity, and there's a popular misunderstanding with regard to interfaith dialogue, which is that means checking your own faith at the door, at the coat check, and then walking in as if you didn't believe anything, just to listen afresh to someone talking about his or her faith. And that's false. Pope Benedict, on a number of occasions, also before he was pope, spoke about the need for a strong personal identity to enter into dialogue. For there to be a fruitful dialogue, you have to know who you are and what you believe. That's what you bring to the table. You don't leave that at the door. So when you go in and speak with someone from a different faith, you are joyfully and with great conviction speaking about your own faith. Also, you know, this isn't separated from evangelization. You also would like that person to embrace Jesus Christ. This is part of what we believe. We're a missionary church, and we believe that when we announce the good news of the gospel, that that seed will fall sometimes on good soil. There'll be those who want to embrace it, and we're also called to be missionaries through this dialogue.
Father Tom Williams is Rector of Theology at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.